Welcome to the Onyx Pathcast. My name is Matthew Dawkins, and I am joined by my co-hosts, Eddie Webb.
Hello.
And Dixie Cochran.
Hi there.
I mixed up the order a little there. I usually go for Dixie first and then finalise with Eddie. But I'm deciding to live dangerously today.
I've noticed that I do that too. And I think it's because Eddie Webb sounds like a punctuation on the sentence more than either of our names do.
Yeah. Yeah. What do you think, Eddie? Do you think your name is my punctuative?
No, I can totally see that because of both you and Dixie have kind of a long sound at the end of your end, a couple syllables, whereas I'm just Webb. Boom.
It's like Dixie Cochran, Matthew Dawkins, Eddie Webb. It's like up, up, down, you know?
Part of the reason why I spell my name the way I do for lots of reasons, both reasons why I started going professionally by it is because I saw something decades ago that said the best way to have your name on a book is if you have more letters in your first name and last name or the same number of letters in both names. So I was like, oh, Eddie Webb, actually that's 4 and 4. That looks nice, nice big block of you know, put my first name over my last name, and he has a nice little block on the cover.
Also, if you kind of flip the D's over, they become the B's. It's kind of cool.
Right. Yeah. There's this visual thing to it. Yeah. I spent a lot of time thinking about this because for when I first started my career, like the first couple of books, if you can find them, I go by Edward S. Webb because I was like, I'm going to be ethereal and have my middle initial.
Edward S. Webb.
And then
that's like a different person to me.
Right. Yeah. It sounds like someone who reads way too much Sherlock Holmes, for example. But Eddie Webb is actually much easier to Google. That was like the biggest part. I was like, oh, okay. But then, yeah, I've also noticed that when people introduce me, people do naturally kind of gravitate towards introducing me last, partially because my last name begins with W. It's later in the alphabet. But also, you're right. I think it's a kind of downward kind of – there's a rising action to most of the people's names, and mine has a falling action to it.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, also good to end on a high. I mean, everyone wants to meet Eddie Webb. And if I'm introducing five people in a group, I'm more likely to end on you, Eddie, because they're going to smile by the time I get to you.
Well, thank you, because I am the dog guy.
I was going to say, do you ever think it's weird, Eddie, that it takes like 4 more syllables to spell your name than to say it?
Yes.
Because your last name is specifically because of the W.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, Webb. Versus W-E-B-B. Yeah. Like, why? Why does it take so much longer to spell than to say?
And it's funny because my wife, I'm not going to give her maiden name on the podcast, but she had a very German last name. Mm-hmm. And so when I asked her to marry me, and she said yes, like the first day or two, she was like, you know what, man, my life's going to be so much easier. My name's last name's going to be so much easier to spell and pronounce. And then she realized that people somehow will find a way to screw up last name W-E-B-B.
Oh, yeah. No, like, I don't think it matters what your name
Kaiser?
Is.
Was it Von Kaiser?
It was not Von Kaiser. There was a Von in it, actually.
Yeah, that is, you know, very German. You know, I'm reading some novels to my son before
German
bed.
Novels?
No, that would okay. be fun, wouldn't it? Because neither of us can speak or understand German. I could read it, I just wouldn't know what it means. And they are novels called Beast Quest. Ooh, and Beast Quest. That's the overheading. The one we're currently on is Sepron the Sea Serpent. And the author of the Beast Quest novels is Adam Blade. Now, that's a that's a pseudonym several ghostwriters. And for one thing, Adam Blade... has completely thrown the idea of having a longer first name than a surname out of the window.
Right.
But also, I saw 6 of these books on the shelf of our local bookstore. Well, there's 5 letters in Blade, and there's 4 in Adam.
Oh, I was thinking, like, syllable-wise, I'm sorry.
Oh, no, syllabically, yeah. Yes. But yeah, I saw 6 of these 6 of these novels in my local bookstore, and I thought, well, this is good, you know. It means we can, every time we go into town, we can get a new one, because they're quite short. It makes a nice, almost a toy out of a book, which is, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. a good thing. And I happened to look online. I made the mistake of going on Wikipedia to look up Beast Quest and Adam Blade, and there are 160 or thereabouts of these fucking novels.
Yep.
minutes.
Wow.
So I've got to make sure that they trail off by number six. Well, we've only got three of them. But by the time we get to the end of the first arc, it's okay, right, let's move on to something a little more concise, like, I don't know, Peter Pan. I do have in fact, on my shelf. I'm looking at them right now. I've got a series of books that are theoretically for children that include Peter Pan, Five Children and It. We've got The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes.
Yes.
And, yes. Yeah, and various others. And I was reading Five Children and It to him, and I didn't know this book. I just bought it as a big batch. And it sadly reminded me, as I was reading it, of how utterly misogynistic and badly toned so many of these sort of 20th century, on the precipice, you know, 19th century, 20th century novels were. You know, I look back at novels like Alice in Wonderland, and stories like The Railway Children with a great deal of fondness, but then I haven't read them in the last 20 years of my life, if not longer. So now that I'm actually reading it aloud and thinking, oh God, the brother is addressing his sister like that and basically saying, get back in the kitchen, and words to that effect, it means that as I'm reading it, despite the fact it's a children's book, I'm kind of having to add caveats or my own edits, because my son's only 5 years old, and as clever as I think he is, I can't assume that he's going to pick up on the nuance of a book being 120 years old.
So I had a lot of these books when I was a kid, because my grandma had like kept a lot of her childhood books. And so I was reading quite a few books that were, you know, out in like the early early 1900s when I was very young. And I remember Five Children and It. And doesn't it have like really bad portrayals of Native Americans, and like the kids almost get scalped at one point?
We've not got to the Native Americans, but it certainly has bad representation of travelers. We've got to a point where the baby in the family has basically been kidnapped by travelers, because they put one of the wishes they made was to make the baby desirable to everyone. I don't know why they made it. It was some kind of heat of the moment kind of wish. And the first people they bumped into was a traveling family. And you can kind of imagine, I don't need to describe it, the way that they are described in this book. And it's all a bit, okay, how can I adjust this as I go through it to make it sound less awful?
That would be hard.
Yeah, the novelist I probably read most as an infant was Roald Dahl. And obviously now and then, but especially now, it is becoming increasingly apparent that he was a dreadful anti-Semite, as well as, you know, littering his books with body shaming. I don't know how much misogyny is in there, but I get the impression
as much, only because, so I also read a ton of Roald Dahl. And part of why I read a ton of Roald Dahl as a kid is because they had books like The BFG that had a female protagonist, and also of course Matilda, which was one of my favorite books of all time when I was a kid. Like I must have read that book, you know, 50 times. Because it was about a very smart little girl. Now that said, I'm sure if I went back and revisited it, there is like a lot of weird body shaming stuff with like Ms. Trunchbull, and like a bunch of other just probably strange things that I did not notice as like a 7-year-old or a 6-year-old, because I didn't notice those things as a 6-year-old. It's weird. I wasn't trained to look for, you know, dog whistles at the at the age of 5.
No, but who is?
Right, exactly. Because like I was a big fan of the witches. I like didn't actually read the Charlie and the Chocolate Factory books as much, but I read like all the other ones, like James the Giant Peach, et cetera, et cetera. And I really, really, really liked them. And I'm kind of like, I'm not sure I'm going to reread those. And I'm not sure if I should ever recommend them to like friends' kids. Because that's the hardest thing now, is like when my friends have kids and they're like I am always the one who's like, can I buy your children books? Because I like books and I want to like give give books I like to children. And then I have to like go through and really seriously think about it or like read a modern review to be like, should I give this to a child in 2021? Versus the stuff I was reading in, you know, 1990. Because right. like some stuff really holds up and some stuff has some parts that I have completely forgotten about.
Yeah, and it's, once again, off on a tangent, but, you know, we're only 10 minutes in, there's still time to recover. It's it's an interesting, it really is an interesting quandary as a parent, you know, one of those awful things to say. As a parent, you want to be able to tell stories that are fun and captivating, and undoubtedly, and this isn't me being a Roald Dahl apologist at all, at face value, Roald Dahl novels are great fun with a tinge of darkness because and I think that really captivates children, especially of a certain mindset, children who hang around with adults a bit more than other children who, you know, might watch TV programs, for instance, that are a bit aimed at 2 or 3 years older than them.
Which in 2021 is every child. Has been hanging around with adults more than children for the past couple of years.
So I think in James and the Giant Peach, for instance, the evil aunties end up getting crushed by the giant peach, and it's described in pretty excruciating detail, much as James's parents get gored to death and trampled by a giant rhino that comes in from the sea, which is it's a fantastic piece of absurdism, which again, you know, I'm not apologizing for his views, but as a child, when you read that or are told that, that's wow, that's amazing. And so I was looking at Fantastic Mr. Fox recently because I think that's one of the only Roald Dahl books I still have on a shelf. And I want to tell a story like that to my son because it's fun, it's amusing, it has a charming protagonist, and it also has a bit of dark wit to it. And also, I don't want the villains of Boggis and Bunce and Bean, one short, one fat, one lean or mean, to be entirely described or typified by the fact that one is short, one is fat, and one is lean, because I don't want him going to school and going around calling a child larger than him Mr. Boggis. So, using my intelligence and my parenting ability, one could say, or my sense of responsibility, I can say, okay, well, it is quite possible to read a story like this and also provide context and make it so that this isn't the big butt of the joke. Mr. Fox's capers are the fun bit. This just happens to be passing detail. You know, it's all about that kind of thing. But at the same time, I can't necessarily prevent my son from latching on to something that he thinks is funny, whether it's Boggis, whether it's Augustus Gloop, whether it's Mrs. Trunchbull, any figure of ridicule in a Roald Dahl book tends to be physically out of average. It's a quandary. Do you consign these books to the bookshelf of history, or do you take the time to basically read them and provide lots of contexts around them, or do you read a story that is more nuanced on the page and therefore have an easier time of it all in all? Long tangent. Let's tie that into role-playing games somehow.
Well, we're talking about old releases, and I'm talking about new releases, which is what I was going to say, but, you know. But, Eddie, go ahead.
I was just saying, like, I think context can sometimes get in the way of the story. I think providing context is good. Let me start with there. I mean, I think that, you know, sitting down and saying, I'm going to tell you this story and also give you the context of why Edwardian paternalism is bad. I mean, I totally see that conversation happen. But also, like, at some point in time, do you read the Alice books and explain all the math jokes, right? I mean, because there's a lot of math jokes in there, many of which I don't even get, but that's part of the context of those books. I could see your frustration or your concern, because at some point in time, it's even worth it. It's like, you know, just forget the book. Let's find something else that I could just pick up and read. But, you know, even modern kids' books now, it's like, now you can't just grab Harry Potter, because you have to give context now for some stuff in Harry Potter, because of what we've learned since then. But some stories do age surprisingly well, almost by accident. Mm-hmm. Obviously, I'm going to advocate for Sherlock Holmes, but, like, you know, the very first story of Sherlock Holmes is about a very intelligent woman who actually smarter than Holmes.
Right.
And it's right out of the gate. And that sets a tone for the rest of it, even though there are certainly parts that are awkward in Holmes stories. Don't get me wrong. There are parts where it's like, yeah, that's not great. But because it starts off with such a strong tone, and it generally, Doyle was more progressive for his time, it's easier to excuse those, because you can give context in small bursts, as opposed to, you know, reading, say, Lovecraft, where it's like, okay, let me caveat this whole thing for a moment.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I think in the case of Roald Dahl, it really is a bit of, like, some of the stuff that rings is like, is absurdity, and you have to kind of just go with it. But my one pushback on what you said, Eddie, is that, like, explaining the math jokes, like, math jokes don't make you go to school and make fun of marginalized people.
No, I understand. I was pointing out this as a kind of an extreme example. I mean,
I
said, I mean, I understand giving context, but I mean, my point is that each person could draw those lines on where the context is necessary and how much context is necessary. So,
yeah, exactly.
I think as a society, this book should absolutely still be around. Like, I don't like the valorization of, like, Huck Finn, for example. I think it's important to recognize that this is the way people talked at that time and given context. Mm-hmm. I also would not be using the Edward constantly if I was reading that story to a child. I would be self-censoring throughout that whole book. So I understand the instinct to, in the moment, say, okay, this is how much context I feel like I need to give, because that's who I think and how much context I believe this child needs. It's more the point, like, I don't think every book needs footnotes.
Right.
No. And I suppose that while there is always the part of my mind, as there is the part of every single adult's mind, of, well, it didn't do me any harm, and you can assign that to anything good or bad in your life for the worst possible reasons, there's also the reality of, this isn't going to be your only point of culture. And so if I were to read, well, I probably wouldn't. So of all Roald Dahl books, I probably wouldn't read The Witches to my son.
Because, oh, that was my favorite when I was a kid.
And also, and I'm sorry, I'm not doing this to destroy you, Dixie. It's also the one where his anti-Semitism is most on show.
Which, once again, I have never, like, I have not reread that book in the past probably 20 years plus.
I
have no idea, like, where that happens, because in my brain I'm just like, but there's a little boy, then he's a mouse, and then there's witches, and,
well,
yeah, it's weird.
Yeah, for any listeners who want to look that up, by all means, you know, do so. But if I were to read him Fantastic Mr. Fox, for instance, I know that I would also be reading him other things. He would also be seeing other things on TV. He would be interacting with other children and teachers at school. Basically, it isn't like the only voice he's hearing is all the villains in the world are short, fat, and lean. He will hopefully, therefore, be able to pick up a tapestry of views and have a responsible parent or two that can, you know, provide some filtering and some clarification. But so, you know, it's all a load of worry over nothing, I'm sure, but still.
I think you have a fair point here, to kind of slowly drag this towards topic.
My God.
When I was sometimes, partially when I was working on Pugmire initially, and sometimes I've learned retroactively as it has become a surprisingly big hit in the therapeutic space of all places, kind of deconstructing what it is. I went into writing Pugmire saying kids are not as susceptible as people believe them to be. Kids have more contextual understanding than a lot of adults give them credit for.
Yeah.
I'm trying to avoid a judgment, intelligence judgments here. Because not, no, that
they
intelligence.
They are sponges. They will take in, and they will hear much more than you think.
Right. So on the one hand, I see the concern, what you're saying about, like, sometimes you need to give context because you don't want them to latch on to problematic aspects of these stories. But on the other hand, like, a trend I've seen of people going, you know, well, that's too scary for a child. I've had a couple people come to me and saying that Pugmire is too scary for them. And a lot of the classic fiction has, like you guys mentioned, it's sometimes absurdist, but it's still pretty violent.
Oh, yeah. No, I read a lot of horrific things as a child that mm-hmm. I was totally on board with.
And, I mean, we've talked about this a little bit in the podcast, but the idea that if the fiction is – the ideal point of fiction is when it's just a bit a little too old for you. You know, so I think a lot of folks who are really into horror really got into it probably when they're like 15, 16, when they're just a little too young to be watching, quote unquote, 18 and older fiction.
And then those of us that got into, like, you know, scary stories to tell in the dark when we were like 6 and 7 instead of like 12 and 13, like we're supposed to be.
Right, exactly. My point is like, because kids like to see themselves as older than they are.
Yeah.
And so they naturally try to reach for that greater understanding. And so they're actively working to pick in this extra context. And what does this mean? And also kids reread a lot more than adults do. I'm sure a lot of parents are shaking or nodding as I talk about, you know, playing the same movie over and over and over again. Part of it's because they're trying to absorb all the subtext because it's not as easy for them.
Mm-hmm. Very much so.
I think some of it is much to do, but I think some of it, I think there's still value in providing the context. But again, that goes back to my original point is I think it has to be unique to each person because each person is going to have a sense of things that they feel they need to give the child context for and also understands what context a child needs because sometimes a child doesn't need that context. No, my son gets that this is an allegory, whereas other children might be like, you know, my son sometimes struggles with what is a cartoon and what is reality and where those lines blur. So I need to get the context for them. So
yeah, but, I mean, I know that we can all sit here and say like, oh, so-and-so didn't fuck me up and I was like a, you know, kid that read all the weird shit. But like when you look at, you know, unpacking things like internalized homophobia and internalized racism and stuff like that, sometimes it did come from children's books and you just didn't realize it.
Yeah.
Like you just never thought to yourself like, oh, I never thought about how all the worst characters in Roald Dahl books were fat people and how that might have impacted my own like internalized, you know, fat phobia.
But
now I recognize I try to unpack it and you try to not make moral judgments on people's sizes, et cetera, et cetera. But like that's something that we are constantly unlearning as adults that we probably did learn as children, partially because all of us grew up in the 90s and prior. And so it was more acceptable to be shitty about that kind of stuff. But some of it was just kids' books, you know?
Yeah. I mean, on the positive side, a lot of my media, you know, Doctor Who, Fantastic Four, Sherlock Holmes, ultimately trained me that smart people can solve problems if they're allowed to be smart. And that leads towards its own problematic endgame.
That's probably what I got the most from Matilda, because she was, you know, a super smart little girl. And then she had psychic powers. And it was awesome.
It's not an inherently bad concept, but like, you know, it can lead towards problematic conclusions if not examined. And certainly there are times where I've examined that and been like, oh, okay, sometimes just being the smartest person in the room isn't a problem. Because for me, at least, the problematic stream was I have to be seen as the smartest person at all times. And that leads to bad behavior patterns. But
yeah, you know, nope, same. I will also point out that every single Roald Dahl book that we have mentioned, aside from, I guess, the ones that feature animals as main characters, has only white people in it.
Sure.
So that's like a whole separate issue. Like you want some diversity in your books. Obviously, you want to teach your kids that like anybody can be a hero, not all little white boys and girls from England, which, you know, you're reading Roald Dahl. That makes sense. He sets everything in England pretty much.
Right.
But like when it comes down to it, you know, having that range for kids, I know it's something that most of my friends with small children are, you know, trying really, really hard to incorporate into their book buying is like, okay, you know, let's have black protagonists. Let's have, you know, protagonists of all kinds of colors and backgrounds and genders and what have you, just so that the kids understand that anybody can be a hero.
Yep.
And it doesn't have to be, you know, the white dude.
Exactly.
Well, let's continue this topic and completely veer away from our starting one. No, but in the field of tabletop role-playing games, because
there are
some tabletop role-playing games, and this isn't a naming and shaming episode, but I would suggest if anything comes to mind, whether it's games or experiences, we can talk about it pretty freely. that you might consider problematic now or contained problematic content, even some that are recent that we can look back on and wince at and wish we'd done things differently, whether it's content we worked on or whether it's content published by someone else since 1975. And I guess my main question, throwing it out to the room then, is if you were to engage with a game like that that contains content, hell, let's look at original D&D. And I don't know if it's original D&D that says that men are always physically more able than women, and women are always more charming than men or something like that. I'm fairly certain it is one edition of D&D. It may even be a recent OSR offering, but... Now, that's not me slamming the entirety of OSR, but I've definitely read about it. But when you come across something like that, that makes a critical and unfair assumption about gender or race in a role-playing game, and it's time to roll out that vintage RPG at the table and play with it, how do you engage with it as a group? How do you deal with it and still have fun with the game while acknowledging and handling this problematic content? It's a big question.
Mm-hmm. I have thoughts, but I would like to go first to make sure I'm not talking over her.
Oh no, you're fine. I don't play a lot of older games, honestly.
Oh, that's fair.
Partially because of some of the stuff, but partially just because that's not what most of my friends are interested in playing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
most of my friends want to play the newest edition of whatever it is, et cetera, et cetera. I will say that before I was super aware of the discourse regarding getting rid of like racial bonuses and stuff, I was already kind of throwing that out in my home games. Mm. In that the main D&D character I talk about all the time, mm-hmm. Jane, like I had a whole thing where I was like, she's raised by dwarves. Can I have dwarf racials? Because she would have been like learned to be these things. She wouldn't. Like inherently be something, she would have been trained to be, you know, stronger than maybe she would have been if she had lived with her halfling, you know, family
and studied stone and all that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. So I like, and my DM was fine with that. And I wasn't even thinking of it in the context of like, I mean, I guess I was, but I wasn't thinking of it in the context of like real world racism at the time, which is probably just my white privilege showing. But I was thinking about it in the terms of like, this doesn't make any fucking sense. Like, it doesn't matter where you're born so much as it matters what you learn as you grow up and what you put emphasis on. Because that's just, I am, I guess, more of a nurture than nature person when it comes to a lot of that. I think very few traits are like inherent. Yes, there are some, but like very few are inherent. It's more about like what you're encouraged to do as you grow up. And that's just kind of how I feel about that in general. Please don't come for me, Twitter. I'm unpacking this in my brain as I'm talking. But I have definitely thrown that stuff away before. And not so much in like vampire or anything like that, because I feel like the clans just kind of make sense to me. Like taking cross clan disciplines never was anything I cared about too much. I was like, just play the clan you want with the right disciplines. But like if you really wanted to, I never had a problem with that either. And like, yeah, I just don't think I play enough older games, or I don't remember enough from when I have played them. Because, like, I mean, yeah, I've played AD&D or one of the early D&Ds, but I was like an actual child, so I don't quite remember anything about that experience. And then on all the other stuff I played was mostly right after high school, until you know, the past 4 or 5 years or so, in which I've mostly played new games.
Right. Well, if I may, before Eddie answers with his big answer, I'm expecting big things from you, Eddie. This is why you come last.
So this could be a huge build up now. It's going to be just a wet fart of an answer at this point.
Well, no, so again,
a farty horn.
Twitter, please don't come for me either. So this is me putting on my most, I guess, generous appraisal of things like ability bonuses in a game based on a character's race, species, people, what have you, is that the game designer who first introduced them, and I assume that's Gary Gygax, I'm not a historian, of our field. It could be Dave Arneson. I don't know. Just simply wanted a mechanical way to differentiate things that you were playing. Mm-hmm. And while it probably wasn't, it, and this is my assumption, I would assume it didn't come in from him thinking, ha ha ha, I hate all orcs, therefore all orcs will have a bonus to strength and a negative modifier to charisma. I imagine that so I think the genesis of it probably just came from that wargaming mentality of I want bonuses reflected, I want negative modifiers reflected, and mm-hmm. one of the best ways to do this is to define it based on fantasy peoples. Mm-hmm. Now, while that may not be racist in, or I guess racially prejudiced in Genesis, it can be, but through delivery, and I would suggest has been, because we even see games released now, and I'm not going to name these ones because I'm not going to give them the advertising, but there's one particularly notorious one that came out, I guess, within the last decade that definitely does make those definitions based on real world ethnicities, cultures, and so on. Mm-hmm. So that system hasn't been extrapolated a great deal to make it racist. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I agree with you, Dixie. You know, if I'm playing a game like that or running a game like that, I would probably think, well, it's not going to harm the game to remove that or to make those traits based on some other aspect of the character, such as profession or life path or what have you.
I mean, I would also say that, like, when it comes to whatever, you know, Mr. Gary's intentions were back in the day, a lot of that shit comes from Tolkien. And a lot of people have, you know, mm-hmm. done lots and lots and lots of research and writing, way smarter people than me, on how that was racist.
Right.
Yeah.
And how all the orcs are, you know, coded as X kind of peoples, etc. So whether or not anybody intended it to be that way, I think the thought of, like, you know, orcs are big, ugly, warlike brutes, and, you know, elves are beautiful and graceful and do not age, this, that, the other, like, a lot of that comes just straight from Tolkien.
Yeah.
And there's many, many, many papers and articles one can read if they would like to unpack that further.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I would say, you know, I'm sure by design, Lord of the Rings isn't a racist dog whistle, but that doesn't mean it can't be used as one. When you look at things like Easterlings as that nebulous, dark-skinned antagonist from the East, there is a problem there, and mm-hmm. it behooves us to be able to address it at the table if we're playing a game around that. So, Eddie, I've kept you waiting, perched on the edge.
No, this has been great.
On the edge of your cathedral roof, like a haunted gargoyle, face twisted in a grotesque. So
it's very hard to talk like that.
Well, you know, I'm now going to cast the spell that gives you animation. So fly, my pretty gargoyle.
So to kind of go back to your earlier points, you both touched on why that particular trope came about. It stemmed from a poisoned well, if you will, of the initial fiction it was drawing from. But also, role-playing games build on previous role-playing games. So let me step back. For context, I think I've talked about it before on the podcast, but I've been doing a YouTube series with DriveThruRPG called History Check, where I actually have been analyzing very specific older tabletop games to talk about them, particularly games that don't get talked about very much, to kind of show how tabletop role-playing games has evolved and show, like, you know, could you play them today? What things you can learn from them, so on and so forth. Because there's a lot of interesting things that we have forgotten over the years in design that could stand to be reanalyzed. But one of the things that a lot of people forget about the quote-unquote racial bonuses is that initially in early D&D, elf and dwarf were a class.
Yep, yep.
So these weren't racial bonuses, they were class bonuses.
Which is weird. Like, hello, I am a human who likes to play an elf, please.
Right.
Wait, exactly. Isn't that what Aragorn does?
kind of make the argument. He's an elf cosplayer.
Yeah, but you can't. No, you can't be a human playing an elf. You right. are just elves all the way down.
Right. Exactly. I mean, it still comes from a place of racial bias. It's the all elves act like this and will do these things. So I mean, there's still a problematic starting point. But as when you had the idea of, okay, pretty quickly was the, why can't elves be warriors? Why can't elves be magic users? And so then it became the Matrix, but the early AD&D Matrix was that certain races could only take certain classes. And then at certain, and then there are level caps. So that starts to kind of build it. And you keep building off of that foundation because Dungeons & Dragons, one of the things that it always has to deal with is always has to be Dungeons & Dragons on some level. This is the great lesson that people take from 4th edition is people, articulately or not, ultimately end up saying 4th edition didn't feel like D&D. And that's one of the reasons why a lot of people think it failed. 5th edition feels closer to it, but that means that there's certain design decisions that were made in the 70s that it still has to kind of work around. And it takes a lot of effort to jettison that, whereas newer games could start from a fresh perspective. But to the original point, I have found when playing older games that a lot of the assumptions can be pretty easily jettisoned as long as you're looking for them.
Mm-hmm.
So two examples I go to a lot is even Vampire Masquerade, to kind of pick on games that we're familiar with. A lot of the original flaws are hella ableist. It's like you get bonus points if you can't hear.
Yeah. Eddie, how are your bonus points?
They suck because clearly I spec'd my character badly.
Right.
I got 3 bonus points for hard of hearing, and I spent them all on Trivia Transformers. It was not a good decision.
I hate to tell you about I hate to tell you about your dark fate that's coming up. But at least you're unbondable.
Hooray. So the idea of this part of your identity ultimately being a penalty, again, you can kind of reverse engineer what that conclusion was brought to, but it still says something awful about the table that you need to kind of think about.
Yeah.
The other example, actually a favorite game of mine, and it's Art Historian, but I'm going to quickly give them credit, Teenagers from Outer Space. It's a romp set up to emulate a very specific style of genre, and some of the things are basically the hot, sexy female alien comes to school and everyone is immediately attracted to her. And there are rules about having boyfriends and girlfriends, and it very much implies a heteronormative relationship and also starts from a position of objectifying women. It quickly gets rid of that. To the game's credit, it does kind of set that up as only one possibility and then shows you a whole bunch of other options that give a lot more agency. It's building off of anime that start from that premise and have that as a core premise. So it's kind of having to say, yes, we're like this, but also there's more you can do. And then like, but it's also really easy to kind of just throw stuff out. Like, you know, the game written in the 90s was like, you know, if you pick, you know, you have a romantic interest, then choose, you know, if you're male, you know, write up your girlfriend. It assumed a heteronormative thing. Just ignore that. It's like, cool, you could be but any gender, whatever. It's pretty easy to kind of ditch that stuff. But again, you have to kind of step in. Like if I were to run Teenagers from Outer Space, I would probably drop that particular trope and say, okay, you know, it's you know, either the hot NB or, you know, just get rid of that entirely and throw a different inciting incident into the mix. Kind of play with things a bit. So I have found that some of these are pretty easy to get rid of, and the alleged harm that comes from removing them that some people seem to espouse on the internet is, in my opinion, out of proportion.
Yeah.
There's just, like Dixie said, there's just nothing that game-breaking about saying I'm a halfling, but I have dwarf racials. If someone is intentionally trying to min-max, just don't let them do that. You know, it's like, I'm picking this combination of things, and I'm going to come up with this ludicrous concept to justify all of these bonuses so I can have a 27 plus to my attack. Just say no. You know, every role-playing game all the way back to near the beginning has highly encouraged house rules explicitly, and from the beginning have implicitly encouraged house rules and expected house rules. So this is one area of art where I feel like we're better because we have this cultural entrenchment of make the game whatever you want.
Yeah. Just
ignore the stuff that doesn't work for you. You know, emphasize the stuff that you think is cool and move the heck on. That does not alleviate the designer's needs when they update older games to try to explicitly remove the problematic concerns. Again, to go back to Artosaurian, did a great job of moving away from cyberware makes you less human and talks more about the place that cyberware has as assistive devices and reframes that into, if you're the kind of person to cut your hand off because you want to have a gun in your arm, okay, maybe you're not mentally stable to begin with, rather than the act of putting a gun in your arm inherently makes you mentally unstable.
Yeah, that's. I mean, like, we talked about that a little bit with Glass and Anima, and how, like, it takes some adjustment. It does. And also with various, like, cyber arms and things. Because with any major modification to your body, there's probably an adjustment period. Mm-hmm. But most people are fine with it, you know? Like, once you go through your physical therapy or your therapy or whatever it is, like, all right, now your leg is made of carbon.
I'll be honest, the first couple of weeks when my body could hear aid was weird.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, like, hell, if I go and get a new glasses prescription, I have, like, a day of, like, whoa.
Yeah.
Everything's real sharp. And, like, that's glasses. That's something that most people are very cool with, which I have recently, as I've talked about privately with y'all and on my social media, I have recently realized you're technically seeing aids.
Yeah.
But nobody's ever called them that in my presence. And I think it's weird that we have normalized precisely one form of disability aid to the point where it's fashion, and all the other ones we haven't normalized yet. And I find that really strange personally, that it's like, oh, glasses are just a thing people have, and it's like, but it's a seeing aid, like, without these I can't fucking see.
I can actually tell you kind of how that happened a little bit. Is
because smart men wore them?
Correct.
That was such an easy gimme when you said that. I was like, yeah, it's because smart men. It is interesting to me.
You solved that in one step, Dix.
Right.
Sherlock solved that in five, so
130 points.
Yes. But yeah, so it is just weird to me, and I wish we normalized more things like that. Like, I understand why this one got normalized, you know. You think of people like Ben Franklin.
Right.
Famously wearing, you know, spectacles, bifocals, whatever. Mm-hmm. Like, okay, great. But yeah, it's so strange to me that I was, you know, 36 years old when I thought of them as seeing aids for the first time.
Hmm. Right. But I mean, to go back to the, you know, updating older games, I've always been a big fan of Top Secret SI, for example, which is a spy tabletop role-playing game. And the original game was written near the end of the Cold War. So there's a lot of anti-Russian sentiment in the game. That's just the nature of being an espionage fan in the U.S. in the late 80s. That's what you're going to get. Or I would even argue the Western Hemisphere, because James Bond also has a lot of that.
Yeah.
If I were to use Top Secret SI to run a modern day game, I would just get rid of that. Skills would actually be a bigger problem, because computers is a much harder skill to learn, because the perception of how well people can use computers is very different in 88 than it is in 2021.
Hmm.
So that's actually the harder stuff. That's the subtle stuff that's harder, I think, to remove, is to think about, okay, why is computer such a hard skill to learn? Well, in 88, you know, you're thinking Apple IIe, most people had to have a decent amount of rudimentary programming language to get computers to work.
Mm-hmm.
Because you couldn't just pop a disk in and start. You'd have to actually, like, get it to run, which involved a relatively baroque set of commands. You know, the cell phones were not a thing, and that changes the dynamic of older games. Well, unless you set it, of course, in the 80s. And the other problem is that if you set it into the time period it was written in, some of these problems do go away.
Yeah. Whereas you look at, like, modern games, like, having no dots in a computer, you can still use your damn cell phone. And you can still probably, like, write emails and stuff. But it's, like, adding those dots in a computer ends up being more, like, hacking and, like, dark web, or, like, being able to program, you know? Because much every human, for the most part, has a dot and computer at this point. Well,
you say that, and I think it is a very recent thing, honestly, where people have started treating games, even if they don't say it explicitly, treating skills in games as things characters can do regardless of whether they've got dots in it. It's just how
like
well
Drive.
Yeah, like Drive, like Computer, like, you know, it's often things like what we might consider knowledges in World of Darkness, for instance. And I can very well remember not all that long ago, pretty much all the games I played, if you didn't have something, that was just something your character couldn't do.
Right.
And I'm fairly certain it was spelled out that way as well, that if you had zero dots, but mainly because of how lowly a single dot in something was described. Usually, I'm talking about dots, so clearly we're on World of Darkness at this point, but this is part of the problem of game design in a way, when it comes to skill descriptors or attribute descriptors or whatever your abilities happen to be called, that you want to state that having one dot in something is essentially the lowest possible competency. But no, the lowest possible competency is zero, but it's still competency. It's not an absolute inability. But going back to something you were saying, in fact, going back to that, the halfling with dwarf traits, I mentioned unfairly a few months ago the Pendragon RPG, because it's a game that, much like George R. R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire, the RPG of which is or was published by Green Ronin, it has this view of women's roles in medieval and proto-medieval society, or Arthurian society, where the knights you play tend to be men, and women pretty much play the role of broodmare. And it's pretty awful and toxic in its oldest form, but with every successive iteration of Pendragon, things have got better. The book has presented that, you know, there really is no difference between playing a male knight, a female knight, or any other kind of knight, because this also happens to be a game where you have stats for wyverns. You know, if there is, and this is that argument a lot of people make about Game of Thrones, they'll say it's unreasonable to have characters like Arya, or to have women who have a great deal of agency or as much agency as men, because this is supposed to be medieval, this is supposed to be pseudo-historical.
And yet it's argument. Also, like, on the podcast, yeah.
Yeah, it's also a series with dragons and zombies.
And magic.
And magic, so come on. And Arthurian myth is exactly the same, that if you can accept that there's a questing beast, if you can accept that there's a mystical and mythical lady in a lake bestowing scimitars, etc., then you can also accept that it is quite possible that a woman might be able to wear armor and ride a horse and wield a lance.
No, women can't do that.
No, all right. I pushed it a bit too far with a lance. Wield a handbag or bunch of flowers.
Frying pan.
I can't wield a lance. I know what you're talking about.
A frying pan, a bundle of kittens. But
it's my kitten and nine tails.
Dixie. No.
What?
No, see, I think what? Dixie wins the podcast. You get the trophy this time. But on the subject of game design and game design of problematic content, I want to pose a hypothetical to both of you. And by all means, you collaborate on this. I don't necessarily want you to disagree, although you may. It comes to a game that all three of us have loved and love to different extents and at different times of Vampire the Masquerade. And you mentioned it, you touched upon it, Eddie. And one of the problems that has been recurring through editions of Vampire is representation of, I guess, what often falls into the independent clans bracket. Namely, what are now known as the Banu Hakim and Ravnos. Mm-hmm. Now, much alike, you will get online people saying, well, if I don't have ability, or give me ability modifiers, or give me death with D&D, and then off they shuffle to their corner. You will have someone saying, well, by removing the Ravnos' compulsion to steal, which I think was maybe the... their original weakness, or it was that it was removed changed.
Thighs.
Yes,
so,
it's
yeah.
changed, but it's changed several times.
No, it was originally there was steal, then it was do a crime.
Yeah,
and then it got changed a couple
of
times.
I remember do a crime.
Yeah. But yes, I may have had the theft thing wrong. At one point, they were just unlucky, and I think and it's changed again for V5 that they have to keep moving around or they will sink into torpor, which I still think bears some issues, honestly. My question to
you is,
how
do you do a long campaign with one then?
You play it like Promethean, I guess, and you never settle in a domain.
Everybody else has to move.
But I guess it's a time for an all Ravnos game. But my question to you, and this is a big game design hypothetical, is you have Vampire the Masquerade right now. It's in front of you. You've got a new edition of it. You have absolute freedom to do whatever you like with the clans, regardless of how it might upset established fans. So you're marketing this entirely to a new audience, this new wave of customers. Hell, you're going to attract the same numbers of D&D 5th edition. Wouldn't that be nice? And this is it. This is going to be the biggest, the best edition of Vampire the Masquerade. And you two are the team who are going to do it. And now your eyes go to the Banu Hakim and the Ravnos. One may be more salvageable than another. My question to you is, how do you handle them? Or do you simply remove them and say, we've tried and we've tried and we've tried and we realize it started off badly and we're best off just cutting them out? So that's the question. Game designers, new edition of Vampire, go.
Do you want the real answer or do you want the answer I want to give?
But no, I'm very interested now, Eddie. Please go ahead.
The answer I want to give is yeet them into the sun.
Oh,
and
okay.
If it makes people cry, that's probably a bonus for me, honestly.
Sorry for my squeaky laugh, by the way, y'all. I'm a little hoarse from like recent illness, so yes. I'm just a little squeaky.
I remember me and Neil Raymond Price's early friendship was based around me continuing to threaten to destroy the Salubri and him being outraged online about it. So I get a thrill from that. But in reality, no, that's not what's going to happen. So honestly, I would, at the risk of stroking your ego, I would probably tell me similar to what we did with the Hakata, which is just completely repackage them and just say the past history existed. It is what it is. And that's not where they're at now. They're in a very different place now. They get wiped out and the remaining kindred reform as a new clan. They get changed by a magical spell. Antediluvian comes and bops them on the nose and says, you're now this, whatever. But they just change to something completely new. And that's just how it is. That's for completely unsalvageable concepts. I think that explicit retconning is useful in certain circumstances, like the Malkavians, actually a really good example. Early Malkavians are ableist. Mental illness is a bad thing.
Yeah.
And now they've just been very quietly reframed to what's wrong with them is completely not human mental illness. It is a explicit curse that does not work in any way, shape, or form like human mental illness. It may look like it, but it's not. And that solves the problem. It's okay, cool. It's not that they're mentally ill. It's that they are cursed their brains to work differently, and it makes them mistaken for people with mental illness. And I think that goes away. Similarly, there were attempts in the past with things like the L'Sombra, because, man, if you look at L'Sombra in first edition and look at L'Sombra now, they're completely different.
Yeah,
I'm a big fan of the way they are now. So,
well, yeah, but I mean, if you dig up like the first edition Sabbat Guide to the Sabbat at one point, because they're just Euro trash. That's their entire concept. they're like fast cars, and they say ciao, and that's it. That's really the whole concept.
How wonderfully early 90s,
right?
Hey, fun boy.
Yes, that's exactly it.
You want to go to the discotheque?
Ciao.
Half of them are named Gunther for some reason. You know, it's
hello, my name is Gunther Darkblood.
Yeah, you had to put a dark in there.
But if, and if you wanted to play Gunter Schwarzblood in the current Lasamba, you theoretically could. I wouldn't recommend it, but you could play that character now.
Schwarzblut. Mm. Yeah. I like it. I like it.
But the point is that it expanded and evolved. At one point, they were pirates for reasons. I mean,
I did love the Lasamba pirate period. That was very funny to me.
At the end of the day, older franchises, at a certain point in time, you just have to accept that the person playing Doctor Who on the screen now is not the same as the person playing Doctor Who in 1961, right?
Hmm.
Star Trek.
I can't accept that.
Star Trek now is not the same as Star Trek in 63. The Marvel comics you read now are not the same characters as they were when they were written by Stan Lee and drawn by Jack Kirby.
I mean, they've Batman's changed. A little bit they different from Adam West's portrayal.
Right. And if you follow them over time, you can subtly evolve them and it becomes things. But sometimes you just have to do a hard cut and change. Sometimes it's like, nope, we're just doing things differently now.
Like a new 52 kind of situation?
Yeah, yeah. A very modern example is Hawkeye's hearing loss. It's going to be, for everything we can tell, it's going to be a factor in the upcoming television series.
Yay!
For lots of reasons, but it stems from comics, but the comics have very consistently addressed that. Mm-hmm. And Disney just decided, we know it is a trope in the previous films. We don't really have a strong explanation for it. It's a factor of the character now. And
we can also see like what the explanation is going to be in the series.
Right, we don't know yet.
That, like, you know, after X happened, it started to affect him, or like maybe he started noticing it, you know, a few years ago, but wasn't really bothered about it, but now it's to a point where he's got to wear his hearing aid, you know. Yeah,
right. But the reality is that from a meta perspective,
mm-hmm.
that was not a factor of the character for him. It was introduced by writers for this new medium,
mm-hmm.
and it has a historical. But does sometimes as things evolve, you have to do things. Sherlock Holmes, he had no family until suddenly a brother appears about 4 or 5 years into his run, and suddenly he has a brother. That was introduced by Conan Doyle, and the fiction was really ham-fisted about it.
Yeah, that actually, like, I don't think I remember that, like, when I got introduced, obviously, like, in the time, because when I read Sherlock Holmes, I read them all in order. Mm-hmm. So you get to, like, you know, X story, and you're like, only
the Greek interpreter
partway Sorry. Through the book, and you're like, oh, okay, he's got a brother now.
Yeah,
right,
exactly.
But yeah.
Moriarty is introduced just in time to die, effectively. I mean, he's introduced in one story and killed the end of that story, but it's like, no, he's been the mastermind behind all of these stories. It's like, but he's never mentioned. So this is not a new conceit. So, I mean, like, mm-hmm. if you as a game designer, if you're given this brief of like, okay, here's two clans, what are you gonna do with them? There's a lot you can do with them. The easiest answer is to just kill them off. And sometimes you're right, a character concept is not salvageable if it is intended to be completely recognizable as the original character. But sometimes you can do different things. Like, here's a slightly tragic example. Black Panther cannot be the same character going forward for a lot of reasons, but the main reason is that the actor portrayed him died and was decided we're not going to recast him. We're going to do something different. We don't know what that is, but T'Challa is not a character in the Marvel Universe anymore. You can make creative decisions that way. That does not mean Black Panther stops. There are going to be more Black Panther movies, and there are going to be more references to a Black Panther mm-hmm. character of some kind. Captain America is black now because Chris Evans is no longer playing Steve Rogers. And again, decided was not to recast him, but to make a new character into Captain America.
Yeah.
Things change sometimes outside of your control, and that's good. I have always argued it is good when a property changes and evolves. So when someone says, well, I can't play Astomites because I can no longer get my Muslim terrorist stereotype character in, the old books are still around. You can play them if you want to. They're still there. I don't want to play with you because it says a lot about you that you feel like that's the only kind of character you can play in that clan. But that doesn't mean you can't keep doing that. That that old media is still there and it's still around. But in order to go forward, you've got to make changes. And if some fans are never going to understand that, no matter what you do, there'll be fans who are mad because you don't change it, mad fans because you do change it. At the end of the day, your conscience and your business plan are the ones that have to answer to the question. So I I'm flip about it, but if I have to make a change to something that I'm in control of and there's no business reason not to, I'm going to do it because I'm going to be yelled at either way. So I might as well do what I think is right.
Yeah, totally. And like, I know you asked
Thank
that
question. Thank you very
to
much
this,
for the long and detailed answer, Eddie. So I now turn to our second panelist, Dixie Cochran, to ask how you would handle it, if differently.
What I was going to say is like, I don't know what I would have done there, honestly. Like, I have never thought about how I would change them. I just thought about how they were gross, you know?
Yeah.
So, like, I do think there is room and even, like, a maybe kind of important place for clans of vampires that are predominantly not white.
Mm-hmm.
Just because of where they're from in the world originally. Because I think it's good to have that kind of, you know, solidarity on some level. But also, I obviously, like, I would want to strip out any racist stereotypes for it.
Yeah.
Because it's like, if there were clans that were, you know, mostly predominant among, like, people in the Middle East or Africa, or even, you know, if people ever get to the Kindred of the East type clans, which have so many problems.
Whew.
But like, if there are vampires in your world and it is our world, but with vampires, then there are probably vampires worldwide, right? Like, that's just how it is. That just makes sense.
That's the math. Yep.
So like, what would that look like in an actually like culturally, you know, sensitive way, kind of like a lot of the stuff that we've done with Scion for second edition, which is, you know, hiring people who have knowledge of these cultures and religions and making sure that we are as respectful as possible while keeping a, you know, gameable system is important, I think. And so I think it would be cool to have more vampire games that, even if they're still set in a lot of the Western world, like, you could have characters from, you know, China or Japan or Africa or the Middle East or whatever, who were different. And I know Africa is not a country. I'm aware of this. But like, who, you know, have different backgrounds, or because a lot of the World of Darkness clans are rooted in like Christian religion as well. When you look at things like Cain, right? But like, where was Cain actually from? I don't think anybody in the Old Testament was a white person.
Cleveland.
so that would be interesting, and also maybe exploring some new clans and new religions, which I know that you've done a lot in Forbidden Religions, because of the rise of things like Scientology over the past several years.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how does something like that affect vampires? One of my vampires I wrote for Children of the Blood is like a wellness cult leader,
right,
in her cabin up in Canada, trying to recruit people, because she's a One True Way follower. And like, that was fun for me to write like a vampire MLM like follower, you know?
Mm-hmm. And I think there's a wrinkle here too. Since the Ravenous were brought up, I'm thinking about this specifically. For a while, I was listening to a podcast called Voice of Latveria, which is a podcast about Dr. Doom. And Dr. Doom, for those who don't know, is Roma. He is not described in those terms. But suffice to say, that is his nationality. And he's a villain. He's positioned very much as a villain.
Right. And he dudes as he pleases, or twos as he pleases.
Right. But in this podcast, someone of Roman descent actually emailed in and said, yes, there are a lot of stereotypes in the comics around them that are kind of hurtful and offensive. But there aren't many people like me I can look to in fiction that I could see that are powerful leaders of nations.
Hmm.
And so, if this letter is to be believed, there are a lot of people of Roman descent who actually really idolize Dr. Doom because they can see themselves, even if in an awkward, problematic way, inside the fiction. So one of the challenges is it's so easy to just yeet the stereotype and send the whole culture with it. I made the joke about yeeting them to the sun. I mean, that's kind of the easy answer, but there are going to be people who are of that sense going, yeah, it's problematic, but now there's nothing for me in here. I don't see myself anywhere in this because it's gone. Even the problematic version is gone.
I also hear that from like some of my queer friends. Like, would they rather have a non-problematic version? Yes. But sometimes they latched onto a character for, you know, reasons. And yeah. So it sucks when that character is gone.
Yeah. I've blanked on the name of the sitcom. There's a British sitcom where there's a character named Mr. Humphreys who is a very clearly a send-up of gay culture.
Yes. Are You Being Served?
Are You Being Served? Thank you.
Oh, yeah, it is.
But a lot of my older gay friends grew up with Mr. Humphreys because, again, it was the only character they could see because he was sometimes above the joke, but more often he was the person, you know, making fun of other people.
He's very arch. He's very catty. You know, he was often the smartest person in the room because he would make the aside afterwards in very pantomime fashion. Mm-hmm. But that's how that was played. And that was a tradition of British comedy.
Right. It has a lot of problematic elements to it, but still it was a character who you could really argue was a protagonist. And just see yourself in a protagonist role, generally winning more than losing, is still compelling. It's a tricky balance when you're updating older material like that. But to Dixie's point is like, at the end of the day, you have to think these things through and you have to kind of address them in a responsible way. And the best way to do is to get people who live in these cultures to step in and speak with their own voices.
Yeah. I also, if I remember correctly, I think that the actor who played him was also queer.
Yes, he was.
Yeah.
Which was like not a thing that people saw in general very often. A like queer character being able to kind of be themselves on some level,
mm-hmm.
Which was very cool. Because yeah, I used to watch that occasionally, and I definitely always kind of caught on to that a little bit. Because by the time I was watching it in the 90s, we also had like Will and Grace and stuff like that on some level. So like you were seeing more queer folks, but even then, like there were only a couple of stereotypes that were allowed to be on TV for a long time there.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that we've gotten way past that is really great. Like I just to kind of get close to wrapping this up, but like I recently watched not all of, because honestly I found it a bit underwhelming, but I watched some of the Why the Last Man TV show.
Mm-hmm.
That debuted like a couple months ago.
Yeah.
I don't know if either of y'all have seen it at all.
I saw the first episode.
I have not. I read the comic.
Okay, so they have updated a lot of the comic for 2021, which is great. So one of the conceits, of course, is that everybody with a Y chromosome dies except for the main character and his pet monkey. That's like something that you learn pretty early on. And that means that trans men are still alive and trans women generally aren't.
Mm-hmm.
And it also talks a little bit about folks who are intersex and what that means and like where chromosomal differences happen, et cetera, et cetera. It does a better job of it than I think a lot of places could. It's still not great, but I was really happy to see trans actors playing trans characters. And I've been seeing that a lot more recently where like if there's a character who's non-binary, they have been trying to hire non-binary actors to play them. If there's a character who's trans, they've been hiring trans actors. If you watch something like Pose, that's like the largest cast of trans women I've ever seen in my life, which is very, very cool too. But like, yeah, no, it's getting more common, but mostly in like kind of niche TV right now. And I would like to see it in a lot more mainstream TV, obviously. But I remember, learning about and meeting trans folks when I was in my teens and just never like, the closest we had to seeing someone on TV was Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Yeah.
And that's not exactly a great presentation, even though Tim Curry is amazing. But yeah, so like seeing that now and seeing it get more and more mainstream is great. We still have a long way to go before we normalize all the things that I would like to normalize. But we're heading in the right direction in media, at least, I feel like.
Yeah, I think that is a good place to wrap things up. So that has been problematic and hard to handle content and role-playing games. Just imagine if we had planned that as the title.
That's totally the plan. Yeah, someday we'll get to the actual episode we've been trying to record for several weeks.
It usually takes us 3 to 5 episodes of rehearsal before we can get to the actual...
Which is cool, though, because we keep stumbling on these topics that are actually really interesting to talk about.
Mm. Yeah.
without really meaning to. And of course, that means that the conversation is more organic. It might also mean that I slip up a bit more when I'm trying to formulate ideas. But it is nice to have an organic conversation with friends. And my final word on all of this, too, will be if you don't like something in a game or something is problematic, please just throw it out the window.
Yep.
Like, you don't need it.
Eat it in the sun.
Eat it into the sun.
Yeah, I often don't include a Ravnos as an option just because... Well, I'll include them as a playable option. Problem is usually their bane, their curse, because that is the part that is most badly grounded in stereotype.
Mm-hmm.
If I had my way, if I had Vampire in front of me to design a new edition, as if I want to do that again, I'd just stick the Kia seed in there and kick the Ravenous into the sun. There you go. That was easy. So, with all that said, Eddie, if people want to find you online, where would they go?
You can find me at pugsteady.com. That's PUGSTEADY. You can find me on Twitter at pugsteady, or you can find me in the Onyx Path Discord, generally posting memes.
And Dixie, if they wanted to yeet you into the sun, where would they find you?
Yeah, if you want to do that, please don't find me. you can find me most places at Dixie Cyanide. That's my Discord, Twitter, Instagram handle. Mostly in Discord is where I get to interact with people, or where I choose to interact with people, like, I guess I should say. And you can find my work at DixieCochran.com with my very out-of-date resume.
Yeah, I need to update mine on MatthewDawkins.com. They can also find me on Twitter at DawkinsMP, and I also happen to be on the Onyx Path Discord. Do check out the Onyx Path blog every single Monday or Tuesday to see our news, and check us out every Wednesday on theonyxpath.com to see what book we have on sale. We release something new every single week, so it is always worth checking the blog to see what's coming up or what's just came out. So with all that said, thank you very much for listening. Many worlds, one Pathcast.